We're doing Jewish history, and we were up to the year 3043, and we had discussed the great famine of 7 years that had been in Samaria, in Shomeron, and this was in the days of Ahav's son Yehoram. And if you recall, Elisha came and told them, "Come, Hashem. So says Hashem that tomorrow, Sa'ataim," we said that's the volume of how many Coke bottles? 40 Coke bottles, right? Approximately, 60 liters or something, 60, 70 liters. Tusa, Sa'ataim, Tusa. Each Sa is 6 calf. Each calf is the volume of 24 eggs. So how 24 eggs fit into a liter and a half approximately, yeah? So we have a liter and a half times 6 times 2. So that's less than 40 bottles. Okay, so you guys can do the math. 12 times 1 and a half, so that's 18. Okay, so you'll be able to buy about 18 liters of flour for a shekel. So the man standing next to the king says, the shalish, he says, is God going to open up skylights in heaven? Where is there going to be so much food? Now remember, our enemies, the Arameans, are camped outside. And they have this huge army. And we see no way out. And there's a famine in Israel. And they can't even go out to their fields. They can't leave the cities. So Elisha tells him, "You will see. You'll see it, and you won't be able to take from it." And so the king appoints him in charge of the gate. Now, that day, we have Gehazi and his three sons. Remember, Elisha had a servant who was called Gehazi. Now, Gehazi was a person who was very, very bad. He's one of the people the Mishnah and Sanhedrin tells us has no portion in the world to come. And Gehazi, I guess Elisha didn't see all the evil sides of Gehazi, or else Elisha saw the good in him. Gehazi prevented students from coming and learning by Elisha. Last time we learned how when Elisha sent Gehazi with the staff to resurrect the child, Yonaven Amitai, no, Habakkuk. So then Gehazi went around telling everyone, "This is what I'm going to do," even though Elisha had clearly told him to keep it private. Gehazi, when the Shunammite threw herself at Elisha's legs, he grabbed her on her chest in a slightly private area and pushed her away. So Gehazi, the Gemara says, was inappropriate in his behavior. And Gehazi, his final straw was when Naaman, remember there was a general in the Aramean army who had shot his arrow innocently, and his arrow had pierced the armor of Ahav and caused Ahav to bleed to death. And this soldier, his name was Naaman. And later on, he was given great honor for killing the king of the Jews, Ahav. And then Naaman had a Jewish girl as his maid, and Naaman broke out with tzaras, some kind of leprosy, which was incurable. And he went to Farparen Amana, the wonderful streams of Damascus, and nothing could cure him. And then the girl said to his wife, "You know, why don't you go to the prophet in Israel? Because he can cure. He can cure. He can do anything." And so Naaman asked the king, send a letter to the Judean king, to the king of Israel, that he should cure me from my tzaras. So the king sends a letter to the king of Aram sends a letter, Hazael sends a letter to the king of Israel, and he says, so says Hazael, "I have a servant named Naaman, he's a top general in my army, I would like you to cure him from his tzaras." So when the king gets this letter, he calls in all his advisors, and he's in panic mode, and he says, "This is a ploy. They're looking for a reason to attack, and now they're just asking me to cure What am I? How am I going to cure his tzaras? Obviously, this is a prelude to an attack. And the Navi sends word to the king, and he says, send them to me. Let them know that there's a God in Israel. Send Naaman to me. So they send word back to the king of Aram, send your general Naaman to the prophet Elisha. And here it pays to go with the text. Let's see. We're about to find out. So Naaman shows up to Elisha's house. He's standing outside. He's on his horse. He has chariots. And he's showing up with a battalion of soldiers. And Elisha doesn't get off his horse, and he doesn't go knocking on Elisha's door. He's standing outside waiting for Elisha to come out there. So Elisha sends him a messenger, and he tells him, go wash yourself 7 times in the Jordan, and your skin will come back to the way it was. You will be cured. And Naaman got upset and he said, I thought he'd come out to me. I thought he'd come out here and call out Hashem's his God. And he'd wave his hands and he'd do some kind of incantation. And then I'll be cured. I have the great streams of Havana and Parpar, the streams of Damascus. They're better than all the streams of Israel. I'll go there and get clean. And he turns around very upset and starts running away. And his servants run after him and they say, our master, the king asked you to do something big? What did the prophet ask you to do? Not something so big. Why don't you just do it? What did he say? Wash yourself off 7 times in the stream and you'll be clean. Why don't you do it? So he does. He goes into the Jordan, rinses him off 7 times the way the man of God told him, because his logic did not back this at all. And there was an element of respect, if the man of God told me I'm going to do it. And then his skin becomes clean and nice like the skin of a child. And he comes back with this whole camp. He comes with this big battalion in the army. And this time, he's not standing outside waiting for the prophet. He goes in. And he stands before Elisha. And he says, now I know that only in Israel is there a real God. There are charlatans, there are people who wave their hands, there are people who say incantations. But in Israel, there's a real force to reckon with. I want to give you a gift. And Elisha says, I swear by Hashem who I stand before him, I'm not accepting a gift. And Naaman says, please, I want to pay you, I want to give you something. And Elisha says, nothing. And he says, no, you've given me so much. You've cured me. I really want to give you something. I'll give you gold. I'll give you silver. I'll give you servants. He starts offering and pleading. And Elisha says, no. And this argument goes on and on and on. And whatever he offers, Elisha says, no. And finally, he says, but I want to ask you a request. Please, I want an area in Israel where I could offer sacrifices to Hashem, because I no longer am going to worship any idols. And please, I hope Hashem will forgive me, because whenever my master, the king of Aram, goes into his church and bows down to his idol, I am the next in command. I stand right next to him. And then I bow with him, but I won't have any intent that I'm bowing to an idol. I'll bow with him as part of the protocol, and I hope God will forgive me. And Elisha tells him, go in peace. And Naaman starts traveling. Naaman has only received, and Elisha has done the greatest Kiddush Hashem. He has shown that he's not interested in Naaman's fanfare. He's not interested in the great army. He's not interested in his money. And Naaman is walking away, and he's dumbfounded. Such purity, such holiness, such a human being. And this argument left a tremendous impression on him. And Elisha's servant Gehazi says, Naaman is from the enemy. He's an Aramean. and Master Elisha, why is he being so nice to him? Why doesn't he take any gift from him? I'm going to go and take something from him. And so Gehazi runs after Naaman, and Naaman sees him running after him. So Naaman, look how respectful, he's learned something. He gets off his chariot and he comes back to Gehazi and he says, is everything okay? And Gehazi says, everything's okay, but my master sent me to tell you two lads from the prophets of the mountainous regions of Ephraim just came. Give me a loaf of silver and some clothing to give them. And Naaman says, I'll give you two loaves. No problem. He says, here. And Gehazi says, no. And he says, yeah, take two. Okay. Gehazi takes it. And he gives him more gifts and clothing. And Gehazi gives it to his land. After they come back home and they're out of sight of Naaman, he takes it home, he puts it away, and he sends the lads away. And then he comes and stands in front of Elisha like nothing's happened. And Elisha says to him, Gehazi, where are you coming from? And Gehazi says, I didn't go anywhere. And Elisha says, yeah, my heart didn't go anywhere. That guy turned around from his chariot and turned towards you. There's a time to take wealth. There's a time to take clothing. There's a time to take olive groves and vineyards and sheep and cattle and servants and maids. Why did he say all this? Chazal say, because Gehazi got all that from Naaman. Look at how he inverted. Elisha had done such a kiddush Hashem, refusing to take a penny. And Gehazi took and took and took and took, and all in the name of Elisha. And so Elisha curses him. And he says to him, the tzaras of Naaman will cling to you and your children forever. And in that second, Gehazi turns white as snow, and he and his children get tzaras. His children had been in it with him. And then they're kicked out of the camp. And they are outside the camp when we have this story of the famine in Israel. Yes. Because they were with him. They went with him to take the money.
Is there any relevance of him going back to the camp when the whole drought ended? Because to say that he was the first to discover the drought, and then when he moved forward, when he went outside the camp, or rather he noticed that the Aramean army had taken off.
That's where we're getting to. We'll see that right now. So, I skipped a lot of interesting stories that we'll do in our class in Prophets, Bezrat Hashem. But Gehazi and his three sons are standing by the gates. They're not allowed to enter the city. The Aramean army is not far off. And they said to one another, what are we doing staying here? We're for sure going to die here. We might as well go to the Aramean army. If they take us in as captives, they'll feed us, we'll live. And if they don't, well, we're going to die here anyways. So that afternoon, that evening, they go off to the Aramean army. They come to the edge of the camp and they see no one. What had happened? Hashem had made a miracle. The Aramean army thought they were hearing chariots coming. And they heard thunderous noises, like those huge armies coming. Horses and chariots. And so they said the Jews must have hired mercenaries, the Hittites, the Egyptians, all the different kings, and they're all on their way here to attack. And the rumor spread and everyone believed it, and the noises they heard convinced them, and they started running. And you know how rumors go. Quicker, quicker, I hear they're behind us, quick, quick! And people were running. And they're running all the way back to Aram. And they leave behind their tents, and they're in such panic that they leave behind their horses and their donkeys. The whole camp is left behind intact. And they're running. And the whole way they're leaving behind one another instrument, because everything's slowing them down. We have a whole trail going all the way back to Aram of everything they dropped on their way to try and lighten the load as they're running. So they come into the Aramean camp. They eat, they drink, they take silver, they take gold, they take clothing, they hide it, they go to the next tent, they do the same thing. And then they say, you know, all the Jewish people, they would all benefit from knowing now that they could come eat. People are hungry. Let's go tell the king. And it always struck me whether we're supposed to look at this as a positive or a negative. Meaning, on the one hand, you could say, they did come and tell the Jewish people before they looted the whole camp. On the other hand, you could say, it did dawn on them after looting two tents and hiding. And the Navi does point out that they first took and looted and hid what they wanted. And then they said to themselves, everyone should know about this, they're all hungry. So I don't know which way we're supposed to look at it. They come and they give word to the king. And when the nation hears that there's all the food the Arameans brought with them and all the wealth they brought with them was all readily available, they charge out. And the prophecy of the Navi that two saw of barley would cost a shekel came true. And that man who was standing next to the king who questioned the prophecy, he was appointed gatekeeper. And when the people stormed out to get the food, he ended up being trampled. And so he saw the miracle come true. He saw that there was ample food, and yet he died of his wounds. He never made it alive to benefit from that miracle. So coming back here, so our story is, who is that messenger? Who is that man? That man was, it says over here, he was Sar Haofim. He was the soul of the baker in Joseph's story. That
who was the soul of Joseph?
The man who stood by the gate.
Why
Sar Haofim? The baker got hung because Chazal say, why did Yosef give him an interpretation of hanging? Because his dream, Chazal interpreted to be a dream about the Jewish people and the dream about the suffering of the Jewish people. And so the idea that that's why he ultimately was hung, the Medrash says, and that's why it says he gives different occurrences in history where this soul came back and always looked badly upon the Jewish people. He dreamed that righteous people would suffer. That was an interpretation of the dream that Chazal tell us. The dream of the baker in the story of Pharaoh. So the loaves of bread and the bird eating it off his head. So Chazal say those were all dreams. Chazal say the butler was dreaming positive things, how good people would have salvation. That's why we drink four cups on Pesach, corresponding to the four cups he dreamed about. The baker was dreaming how righteous people would suffer. And that's why his dream, that's why Yosef interpreted for him that he would end up hanging. And that's why here also, just like the baker in his mind's eye is seeing how good people will suffer, so too this man in his eye wasn't willing to see that positive things would come even when the prophet tells him it's going to come. That's the idea that he quotes here. Okay, so we're up to Yehoram ben Yehoshaphat, the next Judean king. Yehoshaphat, if you recall, was saved at the war when he went with Ahav, right? They captured him, they held him by the head, they took the sword, and the sword was lying on his throat, and then he let out a wail in a prayer, and his prayer was accepted. And even though the sword was by his throat, that second they said, this isn't Ahav, this isn't the man we want, and they let him go. And then they went searching for Ahav again. So Yehoshaphat was the pious king of Yehuda who walked away alive. And his son Yehoram is now going to take the throne at 32 years old. And we'll pick up here. B'zat Hashem next time.